The Packers went into Sunday night's game in pretty good shape from an injury standpoint. Other than Sam Shields, who was in the concussion protocol, life was good. Until Latroy Guyon went down with a knee injury and could miss several weeks. Morgan Burnett left late with a hamstring injury. And there's apparently some concern about linebacker Clay Matthews, who suffered an ankle injury and tried to play through it until coming off in the end. Mike McCarthy says he won't have injury updates on those players until Wednesday. I'm Bill Scott. I'll have more from Titletown later on the Wisconsin Radio Network.
Thank you, BS. 16 minutes until 10 o'clock on this tremendous Tuesday morning. This is your friendly neighborhood radio talk show host, play-by-play man, and color analyst for life, all rolled up into one nice, neat package. And he is a superstar member of our power rotation. Please welcome back the author of the book, The Sun and the Moon and the Rolling Stones, and the Monsters, about the 1985 Chicago Bears, our man Rich Cohn. Good morning, Rich.
Hey, how are you?
I have no complaints, sir, but thank you for caring enough to ask. How are you?
I'm good. Smarting from that Bears loss last night.
I was going to ask you about that. What kind of hope could Chicago Bears fans in this area, nationwide, have any for this season and anything going forward?
I remember that when the Cubs got eliminated from the playoffs one year, like in the mid-90s, the Mark Grace Cubs, they interviewed Mark Grace in the locker room after the Cubs lost to San Francisco. Maybe that was the early 90s. I'm getting so old. And he said, "What do you have to say, you know, to Cubs fans?" And he said, "Go Bears." And I think now we're in a reverse situation.
Isn't that
something?
We're
just so grateful about the Cubs. We're just, like, the Bears thing is a bummer, but all focus is on the Cubs right now.
Unless you're a White Sox fan and a Cubs hater, then it's really a miserable season, and all you have to look forward to are the Blackhawks.
I don't know. Even a White Sox fan, I know they hate the Cubs and all, but it's always good for Chicago when they have a winning team. I always felt like when the White Sox won, I was happy about it.
Well, I'm not a hater.
Yeah.
If my team's not in it, and I have people that I love and that I'm friends with that I know are fans, I'm a fan. My brother, Jimmy, married into the White Sox organization. He's actually a minority shareholder through marriage. And so he went from being a Cubs fan to a Cubs hater and obviously a White Sox fan. When the White Sox beat the Astros for the World Series, I was thrilled. I was cheering for them, absolutely. I don't understand the hating of other teams when your team is not involved.
No. I don't get it either. It's like, I remember that, you know, it just reminds me, like, my father once saying to me about friends being very successful. Somebody was, like, sort of going after a friend who was having a lot of success, and he said, "Hey, look, someone's going to be successful. Wouldn't you rather be your friends?"
Exactly.
You know? And that's how I feel about the White Sox, and it's sort of, you know, it's there's something great about being a White Sox fan. I'm just not one. You know, it's like you don't really get to choose. It's sort of, when you're a kid, like, your parents choose your street, and that determines who your friends are and ultimately determines what team you follow. You know, my father tried to make me, by sheer force of will, a Yankees fan because he was from New York. But the real story of that is he grew up in Brooklyn but was a Yankees fan, where he had a run for his life every day because that was like the Brooklyn Dodgers era. So I think that, you know, I just think it's so good for Chicago when they win. And the Cubs haven't won since 1908. So the fear of that is that it's so deep in being a Cubs fan, and people get mad at me when I say this, but the whole losing thing is so deeply a part of being a Cubs fan that you think if and when the Cubs win the World Series, it's going to be kind of a loss of identity. You know, it's like, what does being a Cubs fan mean? So that's a whole other issue. But the White Sox, you know, the White Sox are always the team that threw the World Series in 1919. I mean, that just, there's something so strange about the White Sox in that way, and that when they win, they, you know, even like when they won, when they play those games in Comiskey Park when I was a kid, you really had the feeling that the place was kind of haunted by that. And it's always made the White Sox kind of really interesting to me.
Me too. And I used to go to, even though I have lifelong Cubs fans, I used to go to White Sox games at the old Comiskey Park. And there's more of a connection to the White Sox and my family besides just the fact that my brother Jimmy married into the team. The Camp Menominee grounds that you and I enjoyed so much as boys. That was the, do you know this? That it was.
Yeah, I remember it being told. I thought that it had been like a White Sox training summer.
It was. It was the Comiskey Estate. Charles Comiskey owned that property. When you drive up Highway D and you see those green and white pillars right before you get to the camp, those were the original pillars from the original Comiskey Park. three Comiskeys ago, and they're still there.
I had heard that. It's one of those things, like, you hear it, and then I remember it when you were growing up, and you think, could that really have been true?
A number of years ago, they pulled the carpeting from the camp infirmary up to replace it, and as padding underneath the carpeting were old 1920 Chicago Tribunes, Chicago Daily News, with box scores of people like Lou Gehrig, Ty Cobb, Babe Ruth, were underneath the carpeting in the camp infirmary.
It's really amazing. You know, and the thing is, like, because when you go back, you think of Charles Comiskey, your idea is always kind of the owner of the team who was incredibly stingy and wouldn't pay the players or trick them out of their money. I mean, that's the legend I grew up with, and there's truth to it and everything, I think. And that was the name of the park, was named after this guy who was kind of this hated guy. But when you go back and really look at him, which you didn't know, was that he was, you know, a great, great baseball player who'd helped start this other league, partly because players weren't being treated fairly, he thought, in the National League. And then, so his story is really, you know, interesting in that he was, I forgot what position he played, but you go back to those guys, and those guys were kind of the guys that invented baseball. So I always thought it was amazing that Comiskey was up there at Menominee, but of course it makes sense.
And he used to take White Sox players up to the estate in Eagle River, and they would train up there.
Yeah. No, it's amazing, and it was, you know, you just wonder what time of year it was, though. They would still go down. Didn't he own, I always thought that he owned, no, that's Wrigley. Wrigley owned Catalina Island, didn't he?
I believe so.
Yeah, and that's where the Cubs would go train.
I mean, Branch Rickey was the one that came up with spring training. They didn't used to do spring training in Arizona or Florida.
He started the modern farm system, didn't he?
Right.
Yeah.
You talk about a man ahead of his time. I mean, that's just what a story Branch Rickey is.
Yeah. Well, it's amazing, too, because there's this great book of photographs, you should check it out, that I really love, called Uncommon Places by this guy, Stephen Shore. And he went out and took photographs, like he drove all around America, like in 1975, 76. And it's like exactly the country I remember from when I was a kid. And you see it, and I'm like, oh, yeah, that's where I'm from. That's the country that doesn't exist anymore, you know? Actually, it still a little bit exists in Eagle River, I feel like, but I feel like mostly you can't find it anymore. And at the end of that book, he goes to spring training, and it's just like a parking lot in a field.
Yeah.
You know, and now you go down there, and it's just other stadiums. You know, it's not that whole idea of being able to go down there and just, he just walks up and takes pictures of Greg Nettles hitting in a batting cage, like a cage you'd find at a junior high school field.
Right. He is Rich Cohen. He's the author of the book on the Rolling Stones, The Sun and the Moon and the Rolling Stones. This is Glenn Klein on WRJN. His dad, Rich's dad, is Herb Cohen, the famous negotiator. And Donald Trump fancies himself, obviously, as the big deal maker. Your dad is world-renowned as one of the great negotiators in history. What is his take on the Republican nominee for president?
I don't know. You know, he won't. No one says what they really think because everyone's afraid they're going to piss somebody off, you know? And I haven't gotten to a big, deep discussion from him with it. I do know that he was really bugged by what his thing is about the way the Obama administration negotiated and projected power. That's not to say anything about Trump. So my father, one of his big things is that weakness is provocative. You know, so that if you what looks like deal making, what looks like a certain kind of attitude comes off as weakness, it actually causes trouble rather than solves trouble. And his whole thing, you know, the thing where my father became famous was during the Iranian hostage crisis. He was in that room first with Carter. He was an advisor to Carter and then later an advisor to Reagan. And his whole thing was that Jimmy Carter made the classic mistake made by people when they go buy a car, which is, he sort of said, we're not leaving without a car. And then you know what happens to the price of the car when you say that. You know, I will not leave here until I buy a car. And that was the hostages. He said, I will not leave the White House until the hostages are freed. And then Reagan came along and said, maybe I'll just blow up the car dealership. I don't know. And then the hostages were freed.
They were freed the day that Reagan was inaugurated. You talk about an affront to James Earl Carter. Wow.
Right. But that was his whole thing. His whole thing was that Carter, it's just a negotiation. I mean, that's how he looked at it. And you walk in, and you sort of, the hostages were the product. This is how he looked at it. And when you sort of say, you say, we're not leaving without these, you know, we're not willing to walk away from this deal. As soon as you do that, they own you. And the price goes way up. And then Reagan said, there's a famous quote where Reagan said, I think they're just a bunch of outlaws and we knew how to deal with that. He made some crazy quote when he was the president-elect. And my father, another thing he did on TV that made him famous is he predicted, I don't know, to within an hour when the hostages would be released. And they were. And everyone said, how'd you do? He said, I knew they'd be released when Reagan was being inaugurated. Because basically they were scared of Reagan because Reagan seemed unpredictable and crazy. You know, and they didn't know what he was going to do. And Carter had sort of, and the other thing was the Iranians had messed up too, because the time when they could have made a deal and gotten their best deal was just before the election. Once the election happened and Carter had lost, then the price came back down. And we were looking at it very mechanically, you know. So I do know that when, you know, during the Iranian, the recent negotiation for the Iranian nuclear deal, his whole thing was, we're just telegraphing that no matter what, they have to have the deal, no matter what. And it's like when you're, you know, a kid and you want to buy a car and you freak out if you can't get it that day, you know. And the whole thing is you have to be able to get up, walk out, and leave. If you're not willing to do that, then you're completely owned by the other side, and then you wind up with a bad deal. And his whole other thing is, a bad deal is not just bad because it's a bad deal, it's also bad because it will fall apart. Because somebody's going to be unhappy with it, you know, and it won't last. So I do know, now as far as Trump goes, I don't know what he thinks, honestly. I'm sure, you know, Trump, it's like sort of, they don't know what you don't even know. For all his things, it's like it's completely baffling. And what's amazing is I watch TV every day, and everyone's like, why is Trump doing so well? And part of the reason he's doing so well is because I think people are pissed off about the way he's covered, the way the whole thing is covered in the news. So it's almost like a revolt against the coverage of the candidate.
Well, it also shows what a significant percentage of the body politic in this country think about those that are in power, both on the right and the left, including including people in the media. This is just a big F you to the entire operation.
Exactly. That's the part that I think that you put your finger on that people don't. They think it's revolt against the political people in power. It's just as much a revolt against the media.
The media, the corporate structure in this country, the whole frickin' thing.
Yeah. And, you know, and it's really, and the more it pisses those people off and the more they can't understand it, the more it sort of becomes kind of satisfying. But the question is, like, it's like the morning after, like, what do you get with Trump? And I don't think anybody can tell you and anybody really knows.
Well, based on your dad's theory and the way that the Iranians responded to Ronald Reagan and people like Mikhail Gorbachev, and you talk about unpredictability, perhaps it might not be a bad thing for
you
Trump.
You don't know. That's what I'm saying. Because the other thing about Reagan was, you know, Reagan was smart. It was an act. I mean, basically, he was ready, you know, at Reykjavik to deal with the Russians. He was ready to make a big deal with them. He was ready to call people's bluff. He had smart people around him, whatever you think of him. And it was, the guy had been around and had done a lot of things. And with Trump, you honestly just don't know. You know, and the news keeps, like, having these things. Like, there was a big story in the New York Times about how, oh, it turns out that when he was a developer, he got special tax breaks. And that, you know, of course, he's a developer. I mean, that's what they do. If he didn't get special tax breaks, he wouldn't have been a developer anymore. He would have been in some other business. You know, I mean, everybody who's ever been in their city when their baseball team threatens to move to another city knows that this is how the game is played. So they keep acting like they're shocked that Trump did these things, that that's how the game works. And Trump says, well, that's how the game works. So it's really sort of fascinating to watch, although you just don't know. But as far as, like, the unpredictable element, yeah. I mean, you don't, but that, with Reagan, it was sort of very carefully, like my father always said, like, you know, when Khrushchev banged his shoe on the table at the UN, you know that?
Right.
And said, we will bury you. He said, if you looked under the table, he was actually still wearing two shoes. You know, Like, he brought a shoe with him just to do that.
Brought a prop. He brought a prop. Well, yeah. Well, Reagan was asked one time, you know, how could you be president and have been an actor? And he says, I don't know how you could be president and not be an actor.
Right.
He's Rich Cohn, and we're talking to him on Community Conversations on WRJN. You talked about the fame that your dad gained. You've hung around a lot of famous people, including Jerry Weintraub, obviously all of the Rolling Stones, people like Martin Scorsese. You've gained a significant amount of notoriety in your profession. What have you seen as a common denominator, Rich, for people who have dealt with fame effectively?
I think you have to be able to basically forget. You know, you get a lot of crap. You get criticized a lot. You get a lot, and it's worse now because people can easily get to you. You know, so the people, and this isn't just like the famous people you're talking about. Like what? Like when I was doing this book about the 85 Bears, the thing that I always remembered about Jim McMahon is he would make a play, throw a pass, be intercepted, something terrible would happen, and the next time he got on the field, it was like he had forgotten all about it. And he would do the same thing again, and it would work, you know. And it's that ability to not brood on the past and, you know, learn from it what you can, but then forget about it and move on. And I think that all these people have to go out and try things and experiment and mess up and embarrass themselves and try again and just be able to forget. And a really good memory is really not a great thing in that regard. And I really think, like, talking about the Bears at the beginning, that I always felt that was a problem with Cutler, which was he brooded. You know, he would make a mistake, and you could see he would still be thinking about it when he went back out on the field, so he'd make another mistake. And he was a great quarterback as long as everything went perfectly, but as soon as things started to go bad, like, mentally, he couldn't let go. And I do think that that is a common denominator between all these people.
How equally important is to be able to forget your successes as well?
Yeah, that goes without saying. They're all kind of like full of some degree of insecurity and self-hate that makes it easy for them to forget their successes, with the exception of Keith Richards, I would say.
Why with the exception of Keith Richards?
I think that guy probably because, I mean, he had his own problems, obviously, with drugs, but I think that he came through all that, and he just got to the place where it's just about music for him. He's like a real artist, you know. So everything else that happens, the fame and all that, it's just a byproduct of him doing what he loves, which is just playing music.
Well, the success of your book, The Sun and the Moon and the Rolling Stones, the reviews have been phenomenal. How much pressure do you feel every time you're producing a new piece to step up to that level?
Well, you do feel it when you're, like, thinking about writing, but when you're actually writing, it just goes away. It's probably the same as with somebody playing music.
Who do you write for, Rich? Who do you write for?
Pretty much write for my wife, I would say. I mean, it's really true that you need, at least for me, you're always writing for one person, you know, and if you're, like, so I am writing, like, I know she's doing her thing, and she'll come home, and then I'll often read her what I wrote, and I'm trying to get a reaction out of her and get her to laugh or something. It's as simple as that. You know, it's just like when you tell somebody a story, you're trying to make them laugh or have a reaction from them, and you're playing to just them. You know, like right now I'm talking to just you. And when I'm writing, I'm usually writing to just her.
What did she think of the book?
Well, she loved the book, you know, but I'm not past believing that, you know, she could be lying for the sake of domestic tranquility. You know, but, like, literally, like, you know, I will write completely over-the-top things and then I'll cut them to entertain her. And I'm sure it's like that with everybody. I mean, it's got to be an element of some, otherwise you're completely on your own, and then, like, who knows where you are, so you're, like, lost. So there's, like, an element of just sitting around telling somebody a story.
Well, I love the story, man. I'm still waiting for my signed copies, by the way.
Oh, yeah. I just realized the other day I hadn't done that. So send me your address, and I'll just send them out today.
I want the Jerry Weintraub book, too.
Yeah, I don't know if I have. I can send you the Russian edition. That's the one I have right here. They love Jerry in Russia.
Wait, what's not to love, Jerry Weintraub? And what's not to love about Rich Cohn? Really appreciate your time, brother.
Yeah, great talking to you.
Your radio friend is AM 1400 WRJN, Racine, Kenosha, Milwaukee, a Magnum.media station.
The community conversation continues after WRJN covers the world on this tremendous Tuesday.
Accused Bomber's Notebook, Bank CEO's apartment.